Good evening, and thank you again for coming. I'm Rebecca McEnroy, and it's so nice to have everyone weather the storm this evening for our wonderful discussion of views and brews of politics, and also the Texas Tribune Tribcast tonight. Should be a good discussion. Before we get started, just a couple things. This will be recorded, so if you have a question, please just raise your hand. And the lovely Miss Kayla Gabriel is somewhere around here. She will come with a microphone, so just be patient. But you do need to speak into the mic, or else your question won't be on tape. Also, a couple people I'd like to thank tonight are recording engineers Casey Cheek and Seth Price, right in the back there. And our storyboard team of videographers, led by Miss Erin Randall, and Matthew McCary, and Rick McNulty. Our lovely bartenders, James Morgan and Chris Luack. Be sure to tip your bartenders. Woo-hoo! And from KUT and the Cactus Cafe, Amy Chambliss, Matt Munoz. Our brand new program director, Mr. Keith Neisler, and Hawk Mendenhall, and Kayla Gabriel. Thank you so much. So we will get started this evening. We have a celebrity guest to introduce the Tribcast, and so I will hand it over.
Thanks, though, Ross. I've been asked to convey a couple of messages. As most of you know, if you listen to the Tribcast, there's always a celebrity introduction. And we have an excellent celebrity introduction this time that's been conveyed to us from fake Ted Cruz. How many of you know who fake Ted Cruz is? And I don't mean, that's not like a way of insulting the real Ted Cruz. I mean, do you know what fake Ted Cruz is? Fake Ted Cruz is an account that appeared on Twitter, sort of in the voice of an alternate version of Ted Cruz who likes to go out and drink a lot and isn't very swift. You can draw your own conclusions. So fake Ted Cruz has sent us the celebrity introduction. He wanted, I hear, Julia Smith to read this, which makes me think that maybe she's out partying with fake Ted Cruz while Evan is here sharing his wisdom. So the message was designed for the normal recording session of the Tribcast, which takes place on a Wednesday, so cut him some slack. And it says, "Hey gang, fake Ted Cruz here. Nothing makes Wing Wednesday better than listening to the bold audio flavors of the Texas Tribune Tribcast. If you're like me, having a few frosty cold ones and lounging in your forever lazy is the way to listen. To Reese Hamilton, Ross Rainey, Emmett Smith, and the rest of the Tribcast gang. So sit back, stay thirsty gang, and enjoy the Texas Tribune Tribcast."
Thank you, fake Ted Cruz, and Professor Jim Henson for providing the voiceover there. I'm reporter Reeve Hamilton. Joining me is CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Hey, Reese.
Executive Editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy, Reese.
And the rest of the Tribcast gang.
Hi.
That's Ben Philpott.
Yes, KUT. Piss all over the public radio guy. That's very courteous and hospitable of you.
So today we're going to put to bed the Perry campaign, I think is the plan.
Please, no applause.
Right. Well, I think the applause is just, we talk about this every week for minutes on end.
We're going to talk about it for the next 6 months anyway.
I'm happy to talk about the Oscar nominations if you'd rather do that.
We're mourning the passing of our primary content provider.
Right. Actually, if you read Neiman Lab, no one won the Perry campaign more than the Tribune.
And we did. He may have had a bad 5 months, but we had a great 5 months.
That's right. But let's get to his 5 months. What happened there?
They didn't prepare for this thing. He spent the first half of the year saying, I'm not going to run, instead of sitting in a war room planning a presidential run. And they started without any plan, and the spotlight turned to them, and they had their moment in the spotlight, and they said, "What are you going to do?" And he said, "I'm going to announce my jobs plan next week." And they didn't have anything to say. And so people started talking about his performance instead of about his programs, and we all know how that went.
I want to take issue with Ross's use of the pronoun they. To quote Ronald Reagan, "The fish rots from the head down." What lost Perry this presidential bid was Perry. Now, the staff has some culpability in this, I'd certainly say.
I wasn't putting it all on the staff. Right. I'm just that whole operation.
I think that Rick Perry was extraordinarily unprepared to run for president, probably to his amazement and certainly to the staff's amazement. He thought that running for governor was the same as running for president. And the fact is, he got out there completely unprepared for the rigors of a campaign, intellectual and physical. And he just was revealed to be significantly less of a retail politician than we knew him to be back here. It doesn't take away anything from his success in those 9 races that he ran and won over the last 25 years here to say that he simply was incapable of running for president.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it took away from his reputation as a retail politician. I think Ben and I were both on the road with him. I think if he did anything right, he did do retail politics pretty well. It's just that that was not enough to actually get anyone to vote for you.
Well, I think what the Iowa bus tour showed is that if he had prepared better and if he had been a little more focused on what was going on, he probably would have done pretty well. You know, by the time he got to the Iowa bus tour, which was second week of December through, you know, New Year's through the caucus, he had a much more refined message. He was delivering a stump speech that was succinct and precise. He was eliminating these flubs. He had not yet said that Turkey was run by terrorists.
I thought he actually flubbed right up until the end.
Well, the last week that he was on the trail in South Carolina, he made a handful of mistakes, I think.
No, but he flubbed on the Iowa bus tour too. Like he didn't know the details of his tax plan, and Bobby Jindal had to help him out.
I forgot about that. That's right.
But at that point, the expectations were that he would flub a little bit.
Right. I mean, it was like a little stumble like that was fine because he wasn't all of a sudden.
Right. The days he didn't make a mistake were the exception.
Right. But you know, he did deliver a good message. He was having those moments. You know, whatever you think of Governor Perry as a politician, when he goes into a room and has a moment with someone and shakes their hand, he has great conversations, and he is very Bill Clinton like in that. You know, people said after 2 minutes with Bill Clinton, you thought you were his best friend. And Governor Perry does the same thing in rooms and did the same thing in Iowa, only it didn't really change much. I mean, it did change. His numbers came up in Iowa.
The problem is he met more people on TV than he did in restaurants.
That's right. And that's the most unique thing, or one of the unique things about this primary has been that the reality TV debates, as some of the Republicans are calling them, really did rule the day and not, you know, the individual. You know, people say, well, Santorum came in or won now. Santorum won because he went to all the counties over and over again. No, Santorum won because he got a late endorsement from an evangelical leader, not because he was doing the retail politics.
No, Santorum won because nobody gave a crap about him until the very end when it was too late for him to be brought down.
Right. Santorum won because he waited around.
He was the last person who nobody cared about standing. I actually think, though, Ben, that with regard to this question of lack of preparation, it wasn't so much that they didn't prepare for the 10 weeks prior to the bid. They didn't prepare for the 10 years prior, by which I mean Perry had no experience debating. This is the consequence of not debating over these 10 years. He might have been able to get away with it in Texas, but the price he paid was when he got up on an actual stage with actual people who meant him harm and who had greater intellectual capacity than Kinky Friedman and Tony Sanchez, he was revealed to be completely unsuited to the task.
Well, and think about the debates that he did have. Who do a lot of people think won the last 2 debates that he ever had before he got in the presidential campaign? Right. Deborah Medina.
Right. Well, the story on those was that Perry didn't crash, right?
Right.
You know, he didn't crash, so he won. It's sort of like David Dewhurst's last debate for Senate. It's like, you know, he didn't crash, so he must be the winner since he's the front runner.
I mean, you mentioned that the days he didn't flub are the days that he sort of, that was a good day for him.
Those that are was also the anomaly.
Days, right. Those are also the days that he didn't make any news. You know, no one's going to report on.
Well, he very rarely.
Today goes smoothly.
He very rarely made news when he wasn't screwing up. I agree with you. Well, I want to say that there's one other thing I think here too, which is that the party that Perry ran in, whose nomination he sought, is also a kind of screwed up party right now. I'm not sure that if Perry had been mistake free, he wouldn't have been too conservative for the establishment and too establishment for the conservatives. I wonder if ideologically Perry just wasn't suited for this field either. That you had to be either all one or all the other. And I don't know that he would have been able to unite the party.
I do think that he was surprised. I was surprised at how his immigration policy didn't play nationally. He was able to be everything to all conservatives in Texas. But at the national stage, they wanted a pure form of conservatism. And the idea that he had any kind of handout to undocumented people in the state of Texas was a big no-no. Now, the debates didn't help, and he said the heartless remark in the debate, and then he had the oops moment. But I think especially in New Hampshire, but also other states, they were not happy with his immigration policy, even if he had done better in the debates.
You know, they knew that was a blemish when he ran for governor, and they thought actually that that was one of the things Kay Hutchison was going to hit him with. And the deflection was Washington's not doing its job on the border. And she got deflected into that argument, and they never had the argument about Texas is paying tuition, because the comeback from Perry was Texas is paying tuition because you're doing a bad job.
Well, and
on
he
the
finally got around to that. He finally got around to the whole idea of Washington's not doing. But again,
but,
it goes.
But they knew they had a hole there 2 years earlier, and they didn't. You know, this is the kind of stuff that they didn't have ready when when he went on the road.
Right. It's that's where preparation comes in, because you have to be able to explain your nuances. Right. If he could just why not make the economic argument for why. These immigrants are handled the way they are in Texas, which if you did it the way that his detractors said, it would be an incredible economic drag on the state. I mean, you could just say that in debate instead of saying heartless. I mean, that the indication there is that just he had trouble repeatedly thinking on his feet. And I think often he's had this history of if he asserts something that maybe hasn't been planned, often his campaign has sort of said, oh, yeah, that's what we think, and moved on. But here, if he did that, you know, he was just throwing stuff out. Like, I don't know if they tested, you know, the idea of sending troops back to Iraq, but that's just an incredible, unpopular policy to throw out there.
I suspect the concept of sending troops back to Iraq had not occurred to anybody in the Perry campaign, including Perry, until 1 second before he said it. But I want to come back to this question of not being prepared for the debates, because part of the problem was that Perry didn't debate, but part of the problem is that Democrats have not elected anybody statewide since 1994. And truly have not put up a serious candidate for statewide office against Perry or anybody else for the majority of that time. I think part of the problem was Perry had no practice debating, but part of the problem was Perry had no practice running against anybody who had a pulse.
Or defending an idea.
Or being made to defend an idea. And so Mimi Swartz wrote in Texas Monthly what I thought was a reasonable piece that said, you know, that blamed the decline of the Democrats, in part at least, for Perry's failure in this race. I think there's some validity to the fact that a lack of competition made him incapable of dealing with competition.
Well, I think you could see that even in the interview that you got with Governor Perry, one of the two separate interviews with the two candidates for governor in 2010. You challenged him on the sanctuary cities, and he told you you were on thin ice.
We asked him about abstinence, and he got all Ralph crammed and Hamada, Hamada, Hamada on us, actually.
I mean, bang, zoom.
But I believe he said that he knows from personal experience that it works.
You know,
One other thing about the president.
I'm just going to take him at his word without asking him for specifics.
One other thing about the presidential race that's different from other races now is that it has a higher percentage of your exposure to the public comes through free media instead of paid media. You don't control the message in the way that you do if you're running for U.S. Senate or you're running for governor of Texas or you're running for, you know, state representative for that matter. Most of what the public knows about you doesn't come from the ads. It comes from news stories, TV clips, and that amplifies things like mistakes in debates. You know, the Democrats had 26 debates in 2008, and nobody flubbed badly enough, at least later in the debates, to fall out that way. But, you know, they had plenty of warning that this was coming, and it's the kind of thing they would have been paying attention to if they'd been planning a presidential campaign for the first 6 months of last year.
And they all complained about how many debates they were, but they can't help themselves except be in the debates,
right? Well, because it's like the only exposure you get to the public. Right. Because you can't afford to advertise, so it's easier to do well in these debates. And you know,
John Huntsman skipped a debate.
He skipped a state.
But do we give too much credit to the debates, though? If you look at the poll history, by the time we got to the oops moment, which we all sort of think of as this pivotal moment, he was already well on the decline and sort of hitting his valley that he would stay at for the remainder of his
candidacy. Well, he had bad debates prior to the oops debate. The oops one is the one that looms large, but he had bad debates before that.
He did. Well, I think Las Vegas was just before oops in Michigan. And the Las Vegas debate, he actually did a pretty good job. He did well enough that the surrogates were able to come out and smile, and you didn't feel like it was a forced smile. But then oops happened, and
oops was the punctuation for all the other mistakes. It was the punctuation on Bernanke and on that weird rambling thing with the maple syrup bottle in New Hampshire. My favorite moment of the whole campaign.
He just kept saying "bring it" over and over in that high voice.
The syrup bottle like this was just
very, very you know. Weird. But the thing I was wondering about the free media, and I guess maybe I was wrong, but I wondered how much news attention to what Perry was doing would actually have an effect on the race in that. So we're talking about the Republican primary, where you have only a small percentage of the Republican Party itself actually voting and paying attention. And in that small percentage, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that many of them believe that Fox News is the only place to get your news. So it doesn't matter that the New York Times has a front page story saying Rick Perry doesn't know what he's talking about, or that NPR does, or the Texas Tribune. If he, you know, I don't think he was getting quite as hammered on Fox News. So I thought, well, maybe it's going to blow over, but it never did.
Well, let me take issue with that for a second. I actually think that part of the problem for Perry is that when he came in the race, everybody thought, oh, well, this is going to be transformational. He's going to come in this race. He's this great politician. He will instantly rise to the top of the polls. They're looking for a not Romney, and none of the other people in the race who's a not Romney or wants to be is likely to be the guy. Perry's got this long record. And so the Mark Halperins and the Joe Scarboroughs and the conventional wisdom meisters of the world all immediately rushed to Perry's side thinking we're going to sidle up to him, he's going to be the guy. And then Perry underperformed, and they ditched him as quick as they embraced him. And I actually think that the level of noise that was anti-Perry contributed at least in part to a new conventional wisdom that this guy wasn't up for it. He suddenly stopped being out of the conversation. He was mocked on Morning Joe. He was mocked in a lot of the places that, yes, maybe the hardcore Republicans who only watch Fox News weren't watching that. But a lot of the people who contribute to the daily conversation on social media and elsewhere were taking their cues from a lot of those national media guys who bought Perry's line and then suddenly unbought it.
And actually, one of the best quotes I got from someone covering the Perry campaign was from a woman who writes for a religious newsletter, online newsletter. And I asked her about the idea that evangelicals might turn back to Perry in South Carolina because he could be considered the most viable candidate moving forward that, you know, kind of carries the evangelical banner. And she said, you know, evangelicals really don't like the idea that people think that their candidates are not ready for prime time. You know, that the only reason they're running is because God called them and not because they're actually qualified to do the job that they're running for. And continuing to push Perry forward would reinforce that belief that evangelical candidates are not ready for prime time, and therefore they weren't going to give him a second shot after blowing it early.
You know, it strikes me that, you know, Herman Cain walks in, and when the spotlight turned to him, he said he had an act. He said 999, and for a while that worked. And for a while that was the difference between him and Perry. You know, if you remember those early days, Perry comes in, I think at about, you know, if you're watching the tracking polls, Perry comes in at about 23 or 26%. It goes up to about 31 or 32. And that's when the spotlight turned to him, and he didn't do anything with it. And then everything else was about how is this guy performing. You know, Herman Cain didn't, you know, just to use him as a comparison, the spotlight turns to him, he has his moment, and he has an act. Talks about 999. You might have liked the act, you might not have liked the act, but he had something to say. And he rode the message for a while, and he actually had a longer arc than Perry did until his thing started to come apart.
Yeah, debate performances did not kill Herman Cain.
Right.
Right, well, and also Herman Cain sort of would play along with the jokes a little bit. I think one thing that Perry, for years, could sort of discount the sort of small group of, you know, snarky left-wing tweeters here in Austin, because it's such a small group and they can't sustain their message, but it's a big enough group nationally to sustain a cable news network, at least. So, you know, I mean, I really think that when people look back at this campaign, the two things that they'll remember and reference are the oops moment, and also that strong ad, which I know sort of, you know, theoretically played well to this audience, but that it was so, there's something wrong in this country when you have gays openly serving in the military and kids can't pray in schools. It's such like a nonsensical, cartoonish sort of statement that the jokes about it just, I mean, instantly ingrained within the society.
Well, you know,
and even the people, I mean, it also gets to the divisions within his campaign staff, because I've even heard his Texas campaign staffers making fun of that.
Well, we've reported that, although they didn't want to have their names so, we have reported and others have reported that they were all very upset about the ad.
They tested six ads inside, and that one supposedly tested sixth was at least the Texas consultant's spin on it.
Well, and going back to preparation, they put the ad up on YouTube with the ability to say if you like it or don't like it.
Right.
And nobody for at least several hours monitors the governor's Facebook page, which is destroyed with anti-Perry.
Right. Right. Every Democrat and every other Republican in the country is going, nope.
Reeve, I want to ask you about this. You know, I realize that there's been a very negative reaction to that ad, but what substantively about it was so bad if you're Perry or somebody who sees the world as Perry does. Perry hates on gays. That's not exactly a spoiler alert. No. We've seen that for 10 years.
But he's not just hating on gays. He's hating on soldiers serving in the military.
Well, and he's running to be the nominee of a party that booed a gay soldier several debates earlier. I mean, I guess I'm not personally, I'm not all that surprised that Perry would put on an ad that hates on the gays and loves on people who pray, because that's been pretty much Perry's whole deal for the last 10 years.
Well, I mean, his whole deal heading into this campaign-wise was jobs, jobs, jobs. You know, I have the economy going for me.
I will agree with you that he had an agenda to run on that positioned him well against Obama that he immediately dropped.
I think it was such a switch and such an extreme thing that it smacked of desperation at a time when everyone thought he was desperate.
Well, I don't disagree with that.
Well, and I think he crossed an invisible line about overtly using your faith. You can use your faith to a point. And you can go to the Reliant Center in Houston and have a rally, and you can do this.
Pretty
and you can
big
do that.
Point.
Well, but I that's when I started hearing from Christian conservatives saying, I don't like that ad. And you know, I'd be curious what your newsletter editor that you were talking to, the evangelical, thought about that. But you know, I talked to a number of people who thought, you know, I just don't like the way he invoked faith in that ad. You don't have to be sitting in the pew every Sunday morning too, and then he's off on that.
When I was in Iowa, I got more negative comments about that ad from people at his events than I did about his flubs in the debates. They don't care about his flubs. They flub every day.
Personally, I was more put off by that ad where it was Anita Perry talking, and then he jumped out of the bushes like the Unabomber, actually. It scared the hell out of me the first time I saw that.
Unabomber is giving him too much credit. Cat burglar, maybe.
Cat burglar, fine.
Do you think he should have stayed at home after Iowa? We had this. In retrospect, everything dropped out. Yeah.
In retrospect, nothing after that went well.
I mean, is there any impact to sticking around for another 3 weeks? Does it make it more embarrassing, the dropout?
They had a bunch of money left. They had another state. They're, you know, if you look at sort of, you go back to the original piece of paper and it says Perry looks good, Perry looks good, Perry looks good. That's the state he should look good in. You have the money to play. Might as well play another hand of poker. So I think they went down to South Carolina and said, maybe Iowa was an aberration. Let's try it. Let's try this message. In fact, his message changed some when he got to South Carolina, but nobody wanted to play anymore.
No, it was again, as with some of the evangelicals, it was, you know, he's had his chance. He's a very nice guy. We liked his speech. We agree with lots of the things that he said, and we are not interested in voting for him.
Well, at that point, they want to go with a winner, and they perceive him not to be a winner.
So now Newt Gingrich is the winner.
Which is so amazing because, of course, Perry's campaign leadership had come from the Gingrich campaign when Gingrich went off on that cruise to Greece for 2 weeks, and they assumed that the Gingrich campaign was going to collapse. It must be a total bitter pill for them to swallow now to see Gingrich up and Perry back in Westlake in the rent house.
Yeah. I mean, has anyone talked to them? Anyone know how they're feeling about Gingrich at this moment?
Well, you know, they left...
Well, they're supporting Gingrich.
One of the gripes when they left Gingrich, this is Dave Carney and Rob Johnson leaving, you know, asking Perry early in the year, are you sure you're not going to run? Because if you don't run, if you're really not going to run, we're going to leave and we're going to go to work for Gingrich. And he said, no, I'm really, really not going to run. So they go to work for Gingrich. And one of the reasons that they left Gingrich when they did was Gingrich would not go on the attack against Romney. So Gingrich didn't move and didn't move and didn't move. And finally, he goes on the attack against Romney, and now he's in first place. So there's a little bit of, you know, if he'd done that in May, we would have never left.
That's the pride. I always kind of assumed the reason he said he wasn't running was just to get through the legislative session. Like, you know, could he actually start running in January when he's trying to do a legislative session?
I totally bought it. I may be a sucker, but I totally bought it. I don't think he wanted to run.
I think a better question might actually be, are those people still supporting Perry? How do they feel about that?
Which people?
His Texas staff went out to support him on this campaign and then got sort of unceremoniously replaced by these national guys that, I don't know which team, if you think one team deserves more blame or the other, but one team definitely botched the deal.
I suspect that they feel a little bit burned by the whole thing, but, you know, time passes. I mean, they were with Perry for a long time, and I figured that they probably go back to being, you know, very happily on the Perry team going forward.
Well, they can just wait until 2016 when Governor Perry's...
Right, when Griff
Ray
Perry,
Sullivan says
Griff
that,
Perry runs for president, right.
Well, what about that? You know, Sullivan came out, said... you know, don't count out 2016. The Republican Party tends to elect second go-around candidates.
Well, Nate assumes that they're going to lose this time.
So now you're playing the politics of governance, right? He's got 3 years left in his term. He's got another legislative session. The worst thing you can do is be a lame duck for 3 years. So he comes out and says, I might run again, so don't go away. And then he says, you know, I still have the power of veto over this session, so the lobby is locked down. And I still have the power of appointment for the next 3 years, so all of you and all these boards and commissions, shut up.
Well, I think he appointed like 12 people today. There was a flurry of emails at the end of the day.
He's back to it. That's right.
Do you think he's going to run again? Would Texas
in 2016 or 2014?
I guess also, what are we? Yeah, 2014 is what I was asking. 2016, do you think he's going to do that?
No. No, I actually think he's done.
I think he's done also.
So what does he do now? What is he going to be doing in 2015?
Preparing Griff's 2016 presidency, right?
And in the meantime, for the next 2 years,
he'll be collecting both pensions.
Do we get the same Perry we've always had, or do we have a weakened Perry now that everyone has seen the chinks in his armor, which are apparently nationally televised debates?
I think he's still got the power of veto over all those bills in 2013. He's still got a lot of ties to the people from whom you raise money for Republican politics in Texas. And I think, you know, he's going to reassert himself in power. I mean, the lobby comes around very quickly because they want to pass bills in 2 years or in 1 year. And he's still, you know, like him or not, the head of the Republican Party and has more juice than anybody else in the party right now.
So what happens, though, when the legislature says, you know what, we really actually do need to work on some of these things that we did for you in the last session so you could run for president, like cut $15 billion?
Well, they're going to have to cut a bunch of money from this next budget anyway. I mean, that's not a Perry issue. There's going to be a deficit of some size that they're going to have to cut.
But there are some Republicans that say this session is going to be about increasing revenue.
Right.
I don't think any of those Republicans was elected on a platform of I'm going to either A, raise your taxes, or B, increase the size of these programs. And
I don't think every Democrat wants to raise revenue.
Well, I think that's probably right.
I just think that the conversation about revenues, it may be more urgent in the next session. But I don't see an appreciable difference between this session and the last session.
Did Perry stray far enough away from the message he's had in Texas in his presidential campaign that it will hurt his standing here? And I'm specifically mean with regard to the 10th Amendment. He used to be, say, if New York wants to do that, they're a state, they can do that now. And then he moved to, we got to get rid of that. Get rid of that on gay marriage. And then with his whole vulture capitalism thing, which lost him a lot of supporters in South Carolina.
The last debate he was in, his biggest applause line was, the state of South Carolina is at war with the federal government. And I think he's going to pick up that glove again, and that's going to be his thing going forward. He's going to be the voice of states' rights or federalism or whatever you
want to call it. A lot of more federal lawsuits then.
Right. And he also serves as the Republican Party's surrogate for the raw edge of that. You know, Mitt Romney can't say that because he's got to be nice, or so-and-so can't say that because she's got to be nice. But Perry can say it, and you can say, you know, what he said.
Well, I think we have to wrap up so we can do Q&A, but do you have one-word summary of the Perry for President experience, starting with Ben?
That's easy.
You can't do oops.
Sky Miles?
Right, the Philpotts are going to the Virgin Islands entirely on the Perry campaign.
I really can't say oops. I got nothing. I can't remember what I was going to say.
I just think the word is underwhelming. You know, I think that it was a lot of hype. Partly it was fueled by people like us.
Well, speak for yourself.
Oh, plug, look. Who told all of our friends in the national media.
I think there's three big lunches up here.
Yeah, I owe lunch or dinner to all of Austin, actually. Because I was truly convinced. I really believed it had nothing to do with want. It had everything to do with what made the most sense in the context of this field. The weaknesses in the Republican field persist. Witness exactly what's going on right now. Perry just wasn't the solution that we thought he was.
But on paper, he's still good. I think you sort of take away the... You know, paper's not everything, right?
On paper, Palin's good.
All right, well, on that note, maybe we'll open this up for Q&A. Yeah. Someone has a microphone. So I guess raise your hand. We can't see you, so.
Yes, but Kaylee can.
One up here.
Do you think that Perry's failure is going to lead to any sort of resurgence in the statewide Democratic Party and candidates?
No.
I love that. No. It's a great question. We get it a lot, but they're unrelated.
Because there's undamaged Republicans behind him. You know, Greg Abbott, the attorney general, wants to run for governor, and as of the end of the year, had $12 million in the bank, ready to go. The Democrats haven't put up a candidate who could win the middle of Texas. You know, it's a conservative state. It's always been a conservative state. You have the 20% over there and the 20% over there, and then this vast middle, and the Republicans own the middle, and the Democrats haven't produced a candidate who's gone for that.
Well, and
in years.
As far as the Democrats are concerned, Perry has been failing for, you know, more than a decade. So, they need a whole sort of house cleaning and new messaging to really resurge.
Paul Burka blogged last week that if Perry ran again in 2014 for governor, that Paul Hobby or John Sharp or some Democrat would suddenly be competitive in a way that the Democrats haven't been. There are a million things wrong with that sentence, beginning with the idea that either Paul Hobby or John Sharp is going to run for governor. Right. The reality is Democrats are still, as a party, dormant, on the verge of dead. There's not a candidate statewide that they can put up this time truly who can be competitive against Greg Abbott for governor or against any of the Republicans who are likely to run for lieutenant governor, and then down ballots you pretty much forget. You'd have to sneak in when nobody was looking. Democrats are still a couple of cycles away, barring something unforeseen, I think.
And a couple of stars away. I mean, they don't have the, you know, the opportunity or the candidates at this point, or don't appear to.
Hi, sorry.
Hey, Paul.
Hi.
Hey. Yeah. I'd like to follow up on what we're talking about now. With Perry not looking forward to a presidential run, again, how's the next legislation or session going to be different? Is he going to be as hardcore conservative and those emergency items, or is he going to be more lenient? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, the emergency items that they started with at the beginning, it's just a year ago. It seems like forever, but it's just a year ago. There were six items. There were initially five, and then there were finally six items that were basically headline grabbers that were appealing to Republican audiences. You know, this were things like sanctuary cities and voter ID and, I forget the rest. But I don't think he has to show those kinds of things again. But I also don't think there are very many people in politics, including Rick Perry, who in Texas politics, who have their eyes further down the road than 6 months or a year and are looking at things, you know, what's the state going to be like in 2 years or 3 years or 5 years or 10 years or 20 years? And so they play small ball. And what they end up doing is playing with, you know, we're going to worry about this budget that's right in front of us and this particular problem right over here and this particular problem right over there. And, you know, sort of the vision thing is missing both from the Republicans and the Democrats at this point. And I think we're going to get another session kind of like we did last time. And part of the reason that was unsatisfying was because they were playing really, really short-term politics.
Ross is quick to point out that we have something like 25 at least retirements from the House, people who are not going to come back.
I think it's 27 retirements, and I think probably another 15 or 20 beats.
Right, so you're looking at a significant turnover this time following significant turnover last time. The Texas House of 150 members will be somewhere between a third and a half people who've only been in the House for the first or second term. We're going to have an experience deficit as well as a budget deficit. At exactly the moment when these problems are more and more complicated than they've ever been, you're losing the most knowledgeable member of the House on education and the most knowledgeable member, arguably, of the Senate, chair of the Senate Education Committee on education, and on and on. You're basically putting the kids in charge of the kingdom. And that can't be good. And these are often people who were elected because they hate government. Now they're suddenly in charge of government. I mean, it's going to be a total shit show.
To be fair, some of them will turn out to be stars, but probably not for 8 years.
And we may have a new lieutenant governor, right?
Right.
And we could always...
Who will have the title but virtually no power, right? Because he will have been or she will have been elected by his or her colleagues. And the fact is we'll have no real authority to hold off the train barreling down the tracks.
And we always have the possibility of a new speaker.
Right.
And on that up note,
Woo!
Everybody get another drink.
Hello, yes, thank you for the opportunity. I had a question about the presidential race going on right now. I've noticed that not only in major media, on whether it's cable or a network, Ron Paul has been largely ignored despite coming in with very strong numbers in entrance and exit polls, but the media tends to cover third and fourth and non-running candidates like Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry, though they're gone, are still getting more coverage than Ron Paul. So my question is, have you spoken with your colleagues in the media and asked them why they're ignoring such a strong candidate? Why and why not?
Well, I sort of think the Ron Paul is being ignored story is a little overblown. Yeah, I mean, first of all, there have been a ton of Ron Paul's being ignored stories. And on top of that, people actually have been covering him. And the thing is, honestly, it's sort of by design on the part of the Paul campaign. Honestly, they are difficult to work with. And then when you ask them questions, they freak out and tear their microphones off.
And they don't make them available.
Yeah. I know there was an incident where we were going to interview a Ron Paul supporter. He, you know, commented about it on the internet, and the Paul campaign called him and told him not to talk. I mean, it's, you know, it's not being ignored if you refuse to participate in interviews. And I think people have been covering him. He doesn't always, when you have a post-election, like post-primary coverage on cable, you do get some of the pundits on cable saying like, oh, well, we can just discount the fact that he got, you know, 25% or whatever, which is obviously unfair and not true. But, you know, the pundits on cable, a lot of them are just, you know, making up stuff off the top of their heads, unlike this.
It's that Groucho Marx joke. I don't want to belong to any club that has me as a member. You know, it's Ron Paul is waiting for the mainstream to come to him and isn't going to the mainstream. The way you win an election is you go to a point where you can get 51%, and you compromise as little as you have to get to 51%, but your goal is 51%. Ron Paul doesn't play that way. He's waiting for them to come to him. And maybe eventually they will. He has for a period get up to 22-23%. He finished fourth in South Carolina. It's not the media's fault. At some point you look at this and you say, look, is this candidate producing the votes this candidate needs to produce, the support this candidate needs to produce? The support he's got is very intense and very devoted. But in three national elections, he hasn't sustained anything over 20%. He's not even running in Florida. So, you know, at some point you can blame everybody, but at some point you have to look at Paul and say, what are you doing to win?
Well, I was still impressed that he was given minimal time even in these debates.
Oh yeah, that's true.
He's not asked nearly as many questions, and he's also being cut off before he's finishing his points. So I would put a lot of blame on the media, and I'll watch Washington Week, I'll watch the McLaughlin Group, and they are still not speaking about someone taking up 25% of
he does not. I mean, with all due respect, he doesn't represent 25%. He has a fairly low ceiling. It's lower than that. I think he got 11% in South Carolina. The fact is, he's a protest candidate. He himself acknowledged this week he's not going to be the nominee. He will control a certain block of delegates, and the strategy now is for him to control as many delegates up to the convention as possible to try to exact some concessions from the eventual nominee and the platform committee. You know, there have been, in every race that I've been alive for, a candidate like Ron Paul, who was effectively a protest candidate. Jesse Jackson was a protest candidate in the Democratic Party for a number of elections when I was growing up. He had a high floor but a low ceiling. He wasn't going to be the nominee. He was a protest candidate. And at a certain point, as the media covers these guys, you've got to make decisions. We sent somebody on our dime to New Hampshire to trail Ron Paul around in New Hampshire. We believed that Paul was absolutely worth covering. We partnered with KUT to have somebody cover Paul in Iowa. You know, we did it, and I think that there are news organizations covering Paul, but at the end of the day, when it becomes clear that Paul's not going to win, you can argue that that's self-fulfilling. And the media fixing the conversation so that the outcome is what the media predetermines. I think Paul himself realizes this isn't going to end with him being the nominee.
But in the NBC debate that you're referring to that just happened recently, he only spoke like, you know, 10 words more than Brian Williams, the moderator. So maybe he should get a little more time.
Well, I think
that
the debate, I mean, you can definitely blame the debate formats in that at the early debates, he was not a high-ranking in the polls candidate, so he got the number of questions that, you know, the lower end got. Now that he's gotten higher up, the problem is Gingrich and Santorum and Romney have all started attacking each other. And the way the debate works, if you mention a candidate in your attack, they then get a chance to rebut. That's why Perry, in Perry's last debate, he talked for about 5 minutes,
right,
because nobody wanted to. In fact, the only time another candidate brought up Perry's name was to say, I agree with the governor. That does not give Governor Perry an extra 30 seconds to rebut.
Think about how John Huntsman was treated in many of these debates. He was barely even there. And when Rick Perry's poll numbers began to plummet and he was pushed off to the side, he had very little time in those debates. There were debates where 15 or 20 minutes would go by when Perry wouldn't even get a chance to speak. So as much as I appreciate your point and your support of Ron Paul, I'm not sure it's exactly right to say that he's being somehow more mistreated than other people.
I will say Ron Paul has better comedic timing than John Huntsman.
Everybody has better.
Not hard.
Even you have.
Even you.
Well, maybe Ron Paul should go
on
Saturday
Night
Live. I
like your Nirvana jokes. Your Nirvana jokes are excellent.
Yes, I had a question about redistricting and how it'll change the makeup in Texas, or your predictions as what'll happen after redistricting is eventually over.
You know, there's two maps now, and I assume that when the court draws a map, it'll land somewhere between those two maps, and the difference in those two maps is about three seats in the Texas congressional delegation between the Republicans and the Democrats. It's no seats in the Texas Senate, and it's about six seats in the Texas House. So it's the difference between an overwhelmingly Republican congressional delegation, Senate delegation, House delegation, or a very Republican.
Mostly overwhelming.
Congressional, right. Yeah. So it you know, it's a relatively small difference. It matters a lot to the national parties because three seats is a lot in Congress. Congress is close to split. In the Texas Senate and the Texas House, they're not close to split. So, you know, those are overwhelmingly Republican bodies, and it'll be a little bit of a difference, and I'm going to miss old so-and-so who got redistricted out of his or her seat. But other than that, you know, I don't think the change in the legislature is going to be big. I think the change in Congress could be consequential depending on what other states do.
But it matters in certain districts.
Well,
it may not matter from an overall
standpoint. If it's your map, it matters
right.
A lot.
Right? I was in McAllen this morning, in Edinburgh, more accurately this morning, at an event with Senator Chuy Hinojosa, Representatives Aaron Pena, and Veronica Gonzalez. And Veronica Gonzalez is, in some respects, the poster child for the effects of these two maps. In the legislative map, she retained only 1.5% of her previous district.
In her neighborhood. It's like your mom and your cousin and your dog.
In the federal court map, her district was much more whole.
Much closer to what it is now.
Much more like what she had. For those constituents, the outcome of this fight does matter. Now, she's retiring in either case. But the reality is, in a lot of districts where the maps are severely at odds, it makes a difference how this goes.
All right, we got time for one more, I think.
Thank you. Who do you think at this point poses the biggest threat to Obama, Gingrich or Romney?
Romney.
Romney.
Neither? I don't know.
Why?
Because no one likes either of them.
I think that, yeah, I mean, what's your quote? The only way Gingrich is getting in the White House
is he goes on the tour. Right. But I have to say, actually, I might actually hedge on answering Romney or Gingrich at this point, because I think Romney has been severely damaged for the general election by the narrative that's played out, partly because of his clumsiness over the last 2 weeks. If Obama decides to conduct this election, and it will take some skill to do it, because he's culpable to a large degree for the problems that he'll put at the feet of the Republicans. If Obama elects to run this election as an election built on income inequality, and how the rich have gotten richer and the rest of the people have gotten screwed and we got to be against rich people, the fact that he'd be running against Mitt Romney with his effective tax rate of 14% and his offshore accounts in the Caymans and his vulture capital, which is not exactly accurate, but that's the impression that sticks, business background. In some ways, you couldn't ask for a better foil for the campaign that the president wants to conduct than Romney.
The Romney machine will probably, the Obama machine will probably do a better job of attacking Romney on Bain Capital than Governor Perry did.
It's 2008, and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are tearing each other apart, and the narrative is he has no experience and can't do this job, and she's married to Bill Clinton, and she can't do this job, and there's no way either one of these people, after they tear each other down, is going to beat John McCain. The subject changes when the primary is over, and it'll be, do you want this one or that one. And if you ask Republican voters in almost every poll I've seen, what's this race about? They finally get down to, you know, after they're through barking at each other about this candidate or that one, we want to beat Barack Obama.
But the question is, does Romney come out of this prime? I mean, I don't disagree with you about Hillary and Barack.
But I think a lot of what you're talking about now with both of these guys falls away when you get to that race. And I think when people sort of sober up and get to the, okay, which one is it going to be, that I think Romney's a much better Republican candidate for a general election than Newt Gingrich.
But the Hillary people were going to be much more likely to ultimately hold their nose and vote for Obama than a lot of the non-Romney people. I think in the end they're going to have a much harder – the evangelicals are going to have a harder time.
So the Gingrich people are going to jump over and vote for Obama instead of Romney?
No, they might just stay home. They might just sit.
I don't think so.
I don't know.
I do think that maybe generic Republican poses a much bigger threat than either of those two. But it just, if Perry was the perfect candidate on paper, Gingrich is almost the worst candidate on paper. And personality-wise, I don't know if he has the charisma to carry, to overcome.
You know, that's
that
just like the mainstream media to say that.
you're such an elite.
Right. If you have other names you'd like to call me or any other questions or comments about this or any other Tribcast, you can email tribcast@texastribune.org. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And I know it looks like it doesn't work, but if you hit subscribe, it will.
I think the subscription is up to date through last July.
Right. You can also just every Wednesday we publish on the site. So anyway, thanks for coming out to our live show. Stay tuned for the act that we just opened.